December 7th, 1941 is a date that will live in infamy. That is what FDR said right after the bombing of Pearl Harbor. Recently, Dr. George H.W. Bush, but the President George H.W. Bush, the last president who served in World War II, and then also a man named Ray Chavez, who was the last survivor of the Pearl Harbor attack. Both of them died. Writing a piece for the USA Today is a military historian named Dr. Thomas Connor, who teaches at Hillsdale. Hello and welcome to this portion of Vocal Point. I'm Jerry Newcomb. And Dr. Connor, it's great to have you on the program.
Nice to be with you, Jerry. Thanks for having me. And before we go any further,
yes,
I'm embarrassed to do this, but I want to set the record straight. Ray Chavez, I had it wrong in the original edition I sent to USA Today, but the published edition got it right. Ray Chavez was not the last of the Pearl Harbor survivors. That's what I originally thought, but he was the oldest living survivor at the time he died.
Oh, I see.
So I just wanted to get that straight. That was on me, though. I fortunately caught USA Today before they actually published the piece. So
okay, I got the idea. But let me ask you this. That was a very divisive time in some ways. America was divided, certainly not as divided as we are now. And yet the whole country came together, you know, and got involved in World War II. If something like Pearl Harbor happened to us today, one wonders what would happen in the aftermath.
Well, indeed, and it's impossible to know what would happen in the aftermath. But I'd certainly like to think that if the country was ever attacked again in such a blatant and treacherous fashion as happened in December 1941, the political divisions would heal overnight, and we would go off to meet whatever threat had materialized as a thoroughly united people. But again, these things are impossible to know, and it's almost it's 77 years later, and the country has certainly changed a great deal since the World War II era.
Are we a different, I mean, obviously we're a different country, but we are so divided, it seems, more than I think at that time, correct?
Well, again, going right up to Pearl Harbor, the overwhelming majority, I think there was actually a polling done to confirm this, the overwhelming majority of Americans wanted to stay out of the war, either in Asia or in Europe. President Roosevelt was reelected in 1940 to a third term, promising the mothers of the country that he would not send their sons to die in foreign wars. But that changed immediately with Pearl Harbor, and Roosevelt actually said later that, well, it's not a foreign war if you're attacked on your own soil. So, but the divisions today are much more complex, and I fear to say they might even be more philosophical, I mean fundamental, in terms of the kind of country we want to have. So, you know, there was certainly a moment of national unity in the wake of the 9/11 attacks in 2001, Jerry, but it's, you know, it's really sad to think that it could take some calamity like that to bring us together in a meaningful way. But
you know it's interesting, despite the divisions people would have had back in those days, it's hard to picture a lot of Americans even disagreeing with each other or whatever on various political issues and social issues perhaps, but allowing or you know, encouraging desecration of the U.S. flag or, you know, dishonoring the national anthem. And yet I think that's almost become part and parcel of today is that, you know, if somebody wants to dishonor the flag, that's their prerogative. I even read about, you know, Stanford wanted one of the fraternities to take down an American flag. That's offensive.
Oh, it's absolutely appalling. And I think you are right. I mean, I think you put your finger on how things may well be different today than they would have been 75 years ago. It's particularly to the veterans. I've had reason to see firsthand what the flag for example, means to veterans. It's because of what it meant. That's what they were fighting for. The flag is a symbol, of course, but and all Americans were pretty much, you know, in support of the war effort during World War II. But to see the flag desecrated, the national anthem basically ignored, you know, it's very troubling. I'm 68 years old, so I was born in 1950, and I grew up hearing World War II stories. My father was in the Army, and to imagine then the kinds of things that we're experiencing every day, and that news from Stanford just knocked me flat. What's the country coming to if it's not all right to just fly the flag because it might offend somebody? That's absolutely ridiculous, especially from one of the premier institutions of higher learning in the country.
Mm. It's not like that at Hillsdale?
No, I could see the flag flying. It's half-staff, of course, in memory of the late President Bush, but no, it's flying proudly here, and I'm sure a lot of other places too. I certainly will console myself, and hope you will too, by thinking that Stanford is just totally out of the mainstream, but who knows where all this is headed.
Tell me about the former President Bush, number 41, and Pearl Harbor.
Well, he wasn't old enough to enlist in any of the military services when Pearl Harbor happened, but I believe he graduated from high school in 1942 and turned 18, which was the legal age to volunteer for military service, and he went right out and did it. And that was the prevailing attitude, I think, among his generation. The country needed rescuing. The country needed defending. The country needed saving. And those guys weren't about to leave it to somebody else to do. They wanted to do their part. And so, you know, his history as a naval aviator was well remembered during the funeral period and the period of saying goodbye to him. But they aren't remembered. That generation is not remembered as the greatest generation for nothing. But the amazing thing about them, Jerry, is those guys, if I'm sure you've had a chance to talk to some of them, the World War II vets over the years, they don't think they did anything special. They think they just did what any good patriotic American would have done. They did heroic things, but they're not about to consider themselves exceptional, really, in any way. It's quite extraordinary.
And by the way, just a little factoid, this radio studio that I'm talking to you from is located in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. And I'm happy to say that our airport in Fort Lauderdale in the 1940s, during the time of World War II, was a place where many military people were trained in flying and also parachuting. And George H.W. Bush was one of them. And they even have a little museum here where they kind of recreated what his space would have looked like, the cot that he was sleeping in, this small little room and so forth, as he was staying in the barracks, learning how to parachute and so forth. So that's an interesting point. How about a comment about Ray Chavez and Pearl Harbor?
Well, as I understand it, Mr. Chavez was on a minesweeper during the Japanese attack, so I gather he observed it from something of a distance, but he was 106 years old when he passed away.
Wow.
Last month, so subtract 77 from 106, what do you get? I'm blanking out. He's late 20s, early 30s.
Sure.
He was 12 years. He was 12 years older than President Bush. So.
So he'd have been about 29 then.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, but he, you know, he was in the Navy. I'm sure he volunteered for that service. He lived in California when he died. I suspect that's where he was from originally. So it's an unexceptional story about a man who did exceptional things at exceptional times, I guess is what I would say.
Yeah, that's,
about him and so many like him.
That's well put. Why did the Japanese attack Pearl Harbor?
Well, as it turned out, of course, they hit us hard and damaged us badly that day. President Roosevelt acknowledged that quite candidly in his speech to Congress the next day. But as it turned out, it was a terrible mistake that the Japanese made. They were trying to neutralize the capacity of the American Pacific Fleet to interfere with operations that they were conducting in Southeast Asia and in the Dutch East Indies, because they attacked a number of different places on December 7th, December 8th, 1941. They attacked the Philippines. They attacked Malaya. They attacked a number of the Dutch East Indies. They were looking for resources in that resource-rich part of the Southern Pacific. And it was a preemptive strike, obviously, and what they were trying to do was take the U.S. Pacific Fleet out of any capacity to do them harm as they were prosecuting their war farther west. But they didn't get any of our aircraft carriers. They damaged a lot of battleships, but a number of the battleships hit at Pearl Harbor were restored and saw service later in the war. So that's what they thought they were doing. I think they also were hoping to stun us with such a surprising and heavy blow that maybe we just give up.
Yeah.
But obviously we didn't, and they wound up, the Japanese wound up paying the price.
Yeah, and there's that old famous phrase that they basically awakened a sleeping giant.
That's exactly what they did. Yes, you know, their Admiral Yamamoto, who spent some time in the United States studying at Harvard in the 1920s, was the mastermind of the attack that the Japanese staged that day. But he said himself, this will buy us 6 months, but if the Americans are still in fighting spirit 6 months from now, we're going to have our hands full.
He did, and he had said literally 6 months, because wasn't Midway 6 months later?
Yeah, it was one of those amazing predictions that actually came true.
Tell us about Midway, because I mean, this is, most people don't realize this. I guess it's my understanding that the cloud cover in the Battle of Midway, the cloud cover dissipated, allowing about 6 or 7 or something like that minutes in which the American planes, without opposition, could just go in and boom, 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 and they were bombing carrier after carrier, and they just did fatal damage, really, to the Japanese on that day.
Right, absolutely. We sank 4 carriers, and you're absolutely right about what happened. It was a very, very lucky stroke in a couple of ways. One, the cloud cover parting, and the second thing was we caught the Japanese. This was why our fighters went in, our carrier-based fighters went in pretty much unopposed. The Japanese they had their planes back on the decks of the carriers being refueled for an ordnance change as well. I forget whether it was from torpedo bombs to land bombs or the other way around. But in any case, we caught the Japanese at Midway at their most vulnerable moment. And because when the planes are being refueled, the carrier decks are just covered with fuel lines and what have you, a couple well-placed bombs, and those carriers went up like firecrackers.
Wow. And replacing a carrier is not something you just, they sunk one of our carriers. Okay, we'll just make another one next week and have it out there. I mean, it's not like that at all. So any last comments? 20 seconds left. Hillsdale.edu for more information. Dr. Thomas Connor. How about just a closing thought? 20 seconds.
Well, it's a pleasure to talk with you, and I hope Americans will never forget the contributions, the efforts, the heroism of the World War II generation. And, you know, we need to remind ourselves that our freedoms, every generation will be called upon to defend our freedoms, and I hope we'll be fortunate enough that every generation will rise to that challenge.
Dr. Thomas Connor, thank you so much for being with us. All the best.
Pleasure, Jerry. Same to you. Thank you.
Thank you now. Bye-bye.